You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
Ever get the feeling you've been cheated?
It is Wednesday, April 9th, 2014. My name is Matt Binder.
And I am Michael Brooks.
And this is the award-winning The Majority Report. I almost said Monday because it's usually Matt and Mike Monday, but today is a Matt and Mike Wednesday. And we are bringing it to you live from the literal but not metaphorical shadow of the New York Times building.
In the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, on today's program, Sayward Darby on the hidden victims of the Rwandan genocide, a whole other group of victims that you have not heard about, and how the problems of ethnic exclusion still persist in post-genocide Rwanda.
And then we also have a second interview for you today with Scott Keyes, who has a great investigative report on what is being called the worst city in America to be homeless. And it really is a shocking story.
It's terrible stuff. Also, an IMF austerity package will further destabilize Ukraine. The World Bank doubling down on failed poverty policies, but maybe that's not really the point of those policies, to alleviate poverty. Also, Illmatic, the best rap album ever made, and one of the best albums, period, is turning 20 next week. I'm going to tell you why it matters and why, if you haven't, you really should give it a listen.
You should see the smile on Michael Brooks' face as he says that.
It's, well, they will see it. All on YouTube.
We also have stories about how those who want to defund and repeal Obamacare seem to be benefiting quite a lot from it. And Sean Hannity reminds us all about the time where, accidentally reminds us all about the time he said he would get waterboarded. That and more coming up for you today. But first,
we are going to take a brief break, and we will be right back with Sayward Darby. Thanks for listening.
I sit the dumb peak watching Gandhi till I'm charged and writing in my book of rhymes all the words past the margin. Behold the mic, I'm throbbing. Mechanical movement, understandable smooth issue that murderers move with. The thief's theme, play me at night, they won't act right. The fiend of hip hop has got me stuck like a air pipe. The mind activation, react like I'm facing time like Pappy Mason. With pins I'm embracing, wipe the sweat off my dome, spit the phlegm on the streets. Sway Tim's on my beats, makes my cypher complete. Weather cruising in a six cab, I'm on tarot deep, I can't call it. The beats make me falling asleep, I keep falling. But never falling 6 feet deep, I'm out for presidents to represent me.
Say what?
I'm out for presidents to represent me.
Say what?
I'm out for dead presidents to represent me.
Whose world is this?
The world is yours, the world is yours.
Whose world is this?
The world is yours, the world is yours.
Whose world is this?
The world is yours, the world is yours. To my man Ill Will, God bless your life. To my people's the wild queens, God bless.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Sayward Darby. She's the story editor at Foreign Policy Magazine. Sayward, thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. So you wrote a really, really fascinating and important piece, another lens to look at the Rwandan genocide 20 years later. And it's called The Tragic, Mostly Forgotten Story of the Other Ethnic Group Slaughtered in Rwanda. What I'd like you to do is remind us of the basics of that horrible, horrible event, and then explain to us what was this other ethnic group in Rwanda that was also victimized by the genocide that we haven't really heard about before.
Sure. So Sunday, Monday of this week marked the 20th anniversary since the genocide happened, and it was one of the worst events of the 20th century, arguably of human history. Some 800,000 people were killed in the course of about 100 days. And the general outline of the story is that extremist Hutus, which is one of the ethnic groups in Rwanda, slaughtered ethnic Tutsis, another ethnic group. And at the time, if I'm not mistaken, the Hutus accounted for about 85% of the population, and the Tutsi accounted for about 14% of the population. And it was an absolutely horrific event. And a lot of the narrative since then has discussed how the international community failed to intervene effectively, and the ways that it could have been halted sooner or prevented. And my story looked at the third ethnic group in Rwanda, which accounts for, at the time and still now, about 1% or less of the population. And that group is called the Twa. And the Twa have long been the most marginalized ethnic group in the country. This dates back hundreds of years. And this comes from a variety of different factors, but one of them is that historically the Hutu were agriculturalists. They grew crops. Tutsis were pastoralists, and the Twa were hunter-gatherers. And they were looked down upon, according to one anthropologist, as more or less than human because of the way they lived their lives. And over time, they worked in patronage systems with other ethnic groups and gradually were forced out of the forests where they had been hunter-gatherers. And during the colonial period, they worked for the Tutsi court, which many Hutus saw as a threat to their existence, the Tutsi court, that is. And anthropologists have described how that built up even more discrimination against the Twa. And in the genocide, the Twa were victims as well. It's very hard to get exact numbers, but it's believed that about 30% of their overall population, which would have been about 10,000 people, died or were killed, and a comparable number fled the country. And it's a story you just don't hear very much about, in part because it's difficult to get information on them, in part because their number is so small, but it also has to do with the fact that the Tutsi government that has been in power ever since has, really solidified a narrative of, Hutus versus Tutsis, and then since then tried to erase a lot of the ethnic designations that have existed in the country for a long time.
Yeah, so that's really important. We're definitely going to come more to that later in the conversation. I want to take it back just briefly, though. So if the colonial context for this genocide was maybe in some respects that the Belgians who were the kind of colonial occupiers of Rwanda, there's a perception, and probably an accurate perception, that they favored Tutsis during the colonial era. I guess what I'm trying to get at is to what extent were these ethnic divisions defined by the colonial experience? Were they kind of generated by that, or were they pre-existing and exploited by the colonial administration? And then how does that play into the politics of the genocide?
Sure, there were definitely pre-existing distinctions between people. And again, this was based on a lot of different things. In part, it was based on groups' relationships to the land, as I described. Mm-hmm. It was based on a number of other things as well. But I do think that during the colonial period, there was sort of an emphasis placed on these things. And as you said, and again, this is sort of boiling it down to bare bones, but the Tutsi were favored to a certain extent. And the Hutu over time resented that and came to power after the colonial period. And so it would be wrong to say that ethnic distinctions did not exist prior to the colonial period, which is something that the government at times, the current government in Rwanda, has tried to say was the case.
Right.
But it is also true that the colonial period, cemented and exploited them to a large extent.
Okay, so we have the story now, and we're of this other group that was implicated very seriously by the genocide. You think you said upwards of maybe 10,000 people were killed.
Mm-hmm.
Was there, during the genocide, was it simply that the Hutus were, was it all lumped together along with this pre-existing racism towards the Twa? Was it like, look, you're going to be part of it, maybe you're not the first priority? Or was there some attempt to not just attack the Twa, but actually exploit them or maybe make them complicit themselves in the genocide against the Tutsis?
Definitely. I mean, as with any situation like this, as with any conflict, the dynamics are not black and white and clear cut. And, it's frequently mentioned, and I say this at the beginning of my piece, when you hear the general outline of the genocide, it's that Hutus slaughtered Tutsis and some moderate Hutus, moderate referring to their political stance. And that's because at the time of the genocide, Rwanda was in the midst of a civil war between the Hutu government and the Rwandan Patriotic Front, which was a Tutsi-led exile group predominantly based in Uganda. Prior to the genocide, there's been lots of documentation of this, of radio stations and other places, firing people up with a call to Hutu power in Rwanda. And in the course of that process, there was there were accusations thrown at the Twa, that the Twa were aligned with this Rwandan Patriotic Front.
Right.
And even before the genocide began in April of 1994, Twa villages were destroyed in Rwanda by some Hutu fighters. When the genocide began, there's been documentation of Twa being targeted for who they were ethnically. There were identity cards at the time, and if you were identified to be Tutsi or Twa, you could be killed, and often were killed, by Hutu fighters. That being said, there's also been some documentation of Twa themselves being implicated as killers. And there is an organization called the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organization that has reported on what they call exceptional cases where the Twa participated in murdering Tutsis. And in some cases, the Twa who were involved say that they were forced to by Hutu militia, that they were told, if you don't do this, we will kill you and we will kill your families. In other cases, they may have participated willingly, although, again, because it's difficult to get exact numbers on what happened, it's unclear why they would have done that willingly. And Philip Gurevich, who wrote a very famous book about Rwanda called We Wish to Inform You That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed With Our Families, has said that in some cases Twa may have been used by Hutu fighters to rape Tutsi women. And the idea there would have been that because the Twa were considered, a lower class and less than human group, that it added, insult upon injury to what was being done. But I think that it's important to note that based on the research that has been done by anthropologists and activists, most of the Twa were likely victimized as opposed to being involved in the perpetration. Again, the UNPO, the organization, has said that these were exceptional cases.
Absolutely. So this is, obviously in the broader kind of global discourse, as you said in the beginning of the interview, the victimization of the Twa is definitely not central to the conversation for a variety of the reasons you outlined. In Rwanda, under the present government of Paul Kagame, who, we should say has been really lauded by the international community, by Western leaders like Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Tony Blair, as a kind of exemplary African leader who's brought Rwanda back. Not just culturally and politically from the genocide, but also economically. There's a whole other discourse about Kagame that there's a lot of human rights violations and a lot of problems under his government, which perhaps you could get into. But, starting specifically with the Twa in the post-genocide era and in this kind of brave new era of the Kagame leadership, how are they outside of the narrative as well, or is the reality different inside Rwanda than it is in global discourse?
Absolutely. Well, one of the big legacies of the Kagame government is that they have really emphasized national unity. They've said, there's a quote actually from a 2001 report by their National Unity and Reconciliation Commission that says, well before the colonial era, Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa were all Rwandans on equal footing. And as I mentioned, that isn't true. Anthropologists have shown that in fact there were divisions and there was discrimination and violence on the basis of ethnicity. And yet since the genocide, one of the big things the Kagame government has done is tried to say we are all Rwandans, we are not divided by ethnic group. And in its 2003 constitution, it more or less decided to erase ethnic designations, and it has worked hard to suppress what it calls divisionist activity. And divisionist activity is very broadly defined and has been used, human rights advocates say, to actually suppress political dissent, people who disagree with the regime that's been in power since 1994. The way that this has affected the Twa is a little different. Basically, they're not allowed to say we are Twa, and the government has more or less cracked down at times. In 2004, the Ministry of Justice said it was going to stop funding NGOs that specifically targeted the Twa if they insisted on being designated as such as a group. So they've accused the Twa of being divisionist and pushing back against this idea of we're all Rwandans and we're not divided by ethnicity. But what that means for the Twa on a public policy level is that there is a failure to find solutions for their very specific problems. And as a long marginalized group, those problems include high rates of illiteracy, very high rates of unemployment. And in Rwanda, one thing that's very important is land. Rwanda is a very small country, and people have written about how, fights over land and disagreements over land actually was a part of the lead-up to the genocide as well. And the government has been managing the land very tightly, especially in the last 10 to 15 years. And the Twa have been found to be particularly disadvantaged in this respect, to have very small parcels of land, not enough to feed their families. But it's very difficult to say we as an ethnic group are challenged because the government doesn't want to actively recognize them as a group. And one of the, I say, more famous cases, but it's really not so famous because you don't hear about the Twa very often, but there was a small Twa advocacy organization that was instructed by the government to change its name, to not use the word indigenous, to say, we are a group that has been here a long time. And the government said if they didn't do that, they would be denied legal status. And they finally relented in 2007, and today call themselves the community of Rwandan potters as opposed to the community of indigenous Twa. And the reason they call themselves that is because over time, as the Twa have been increasingly pushed out of the forests where they have lived for a long time, they've turned to pottery, to making pottery to find income. And the organization's leader said, I think as recently as a few months ago, that he sees the Twa as invisible to the government at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm obviously not drawing a direct analogy here, but it just seems like that is such a we're all Americans, so we cannot talk about the specific problems of African Americans or women.
Exactly.
There is just that kind of papering over, which never allows for, you can't turn the page of history until it's been written. So mm-hmm. I'm guessing that this has very specific, I mean, you've already said the specific effects in terms of crackdowns on human rights and civil society organizing, mm-hmm. but we're also talking mm-hmm. about a history that you alluded to even before the genocide where, in addition to, taking the Twa specifically, so obviously there's a colonial history in Rwanda which implicates taking land from all Rwandan ethnic groups because mm-hmm. that's what colonialism is. And then mm-hmm. with the Twa specifically, you're talking about a colonial experience. Then you're also talking as hunter-gatherers, you're getting land taken from maybe people who farm, by people who farm, other ethnic groups or pastoralists.
Correct.
So they've taken it from all of these sides, plus their own refugee, their own fleeing during the genocide as well as victimization. So is this also very specifically affecting how they're getting reparations or compensation, essentially, to help them kind of rebuild their lives in the modern Rwandan economy?
Absolutely. There's been some research showing that more or less nothing has been done to help them specifically. And I mentioned in my article that there have been some token moves over time. In 2006, Kagame appointed a TWA senator, for instance. But ultimately, there's just been very little targeted concern for their well-being. And with regard to reparations specifically, in 1998, the government set up something that's known as the FARG. It's a survivors fund. And it's intended to help financially those who were targeted in the genocide and survived. And research has shown by two anthropologists in the United States, I believe, that this money has been channeled overwhelmingly to Tutsi. Now, on the one hand, the Tutsi were the ones who were, you know, proportionally speaking, the most victimized. On the other hand, research shows that some of this money has actually gone to Tutsi returnees to the country who left well before the genocide. You'll remember that I mentioned the Rwandan Patriotic Front had been in Uganda prior to the genocide, and there were lots of Tutsi refugees living outside of Rwanda's borders before the killings of 1994. And what has been shown is that some money has been going back to people who were not in the country during the genocide. And similarly, there hasn't been a strong concern showed for the TWA's experience and what sort of, you know, compensation and reparations they should receive after the fact, or should have received after the fact.
Right. So, you know, I guess moving more broadly as we move towards the end of this conversation, I mean, I think that this is another strand that implicates the Kagame government. And you know, it seems like part of some of the outpouring of support for him from the international community has been because, look, he's had some real successes and he has, you know, he's an effective manager in some respects. But it also seems like a kind of, in some cases, even just guilt from maybe someone like President Clinton because of really the, yeah, I mean, in fact, the very shameful conduct of Western governments and the American government during the genocide has led to this kind of, you know, because it's not just issues with the TWA. There's all sorts of other human rights issues mm-hmm. that this government has been implicated in. And I think, I mean, how long can an arrangement be sustained where the Kagame government is not held to account because, you know, because it arose from this horrific history and because it's, mm-hmm. I guess, in the overall sense, managed this transition fairly well? How mm-hmm. long can that be used to kind of sweep these other things under the rug? And I guess connected with that, is he, you know, is he with all of these blemishes, is he still, you know, the best shot that Rwanda has right now?
Sure. I mean, those are hard questions. And to the first one, you know, how long can this go on? A really long time.
Right.
It has been going on for a really long time. In the immediate aftermath of the genocide, the RPF government that took over went after Hutu refugees. And in 1996, they went into what was then Zaire and is now Democratic Republic of Congo and went after Hutus. And we have a wonderful piece by Michaela Rong, who's a fabulous journalist who covers East Africa. And she wrote a piece just prior to my piece coming out about accusations against the Kagame government from that time on. And, you know, she touches on the fact that they went after these Hutu refugees. But she also talks about some very disturbing allegations that the government has been murdering political dissidents, and not just murdering them within Rwanda's borders, but outside. There was a pretty high-profile case at the end of 2013 in South Africa where a known political dissident was murdered in a hotel room, and the Kagame government has denied these accusations. But increasingly, there is concern that they are true. South Africa actually expelled some Rwandan diplomats. The U.S. State Department has expressed concern. And yet, just like many, you know, governments that abuse human rights, whether we're talking about assassinations or suppressing dissent, suppressing media, whatever it may be, you know, aid continues to flow when development is going well. And Michaela Rong talks about this in her piece and cites Ethiopia as another example of, you know, where aid has continued to flow from the West, even when human rights concerns are very, very large. And so, you know, is aid always going to continue exactly as it has? Is support always going to continue exactly as it has? No, and I do think we are seeing some shifts. At least one senator in the U.S. Congress has talked about needing to limit aid to Rwanda on the basis of accusations about assassinations and other abuses. And yet, you know, there is a lot of thinking and concern that if you are to cut off flows of money, cut off that support, other things could go wrong. And it's true that since coming to power, the Kagame government has overseen a very peaceful Rwanda. And if you consider that in comparison to places like Liberia, Angola, other countries that had various spurts of really horrific violence and continued to fall back into them, you know, stretching 20 years pretty peacefully inside of Rwanda's borders is quite remarkable. And so, you know, there are no easy answers here, but I do think that already over the course of two decades, we've seen the West continue to show support for the Rwandan government and for Paul Kagame, even as these allegations have mounted, even as they have become more intense. And again, that started right after the genocide. So I think it's something to keep an eye on. I think it will be very interesting to see what happens in the coming years. And I definitely recommend reading Michaela Rong's piece to get a better sense of what some of these accusations against the government have been.
Well, and it's actually fascinating because in some respects, it's also another subtext of our own kind of transition to targeted killing programs and things like that, how that also complicates even having a conversation about that in some respects. But this is an excellent piece. The piece is The Tragic, Mostly Forgotten Story of the Other Ethnic Groups Slaughtered in Rwanda. Sayward Darby, story editor at Foreign Policy Magazine, thank you so much for joining me on the Majority Report.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
Great talking with you. Thank you. All right, folks, so we are going to just take a brief switch, and Matt's going to talk with you, talk with Scott Keyes about the worst town to be homeless in America, and then, of course, we'll go to the fun half where we have many more fun things for you. What are we putting on Mission Impossible?
I have music for right now.
Okay, all right.
We'll do Mission Impossible for the...
Okay, we'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm here with my co-host today, Michael Brooks. My name is Matt Binder. And joining us now, he's a reporter for Think Progress, Scott Keyes. And we're going to discuss this his latest for Think Progress. It's a really great investigative report into Shawnee, Oklahoma, which Scott calls the worst city in America to be homeless. And he's going to tell us why. Scott, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me on, guys.
Thanks for coming on. Scott, first of all, this is really, I encourage everyone to go to Think Progress and read this. It's called Welcome to Shawnee, Oklahoma, the worst city in America to be homeless, because it is a real deep dive into this city, which you're going to tell us why you're calling it the worst city in America to be homeless. So let's just start with that. What's going on in Shawnee?
Yeah, so, you know, I don't use that term lightly, because homelessness is an issue that I've been covering for a while now, and writing on different policies, you know, in Tampa or Palo Alto or Miami, you know, all across the country. So I've seen a lot of policies that are really vindictive towards homeless people. But what I encountered in just researching and digging into what's been going on in Shawnee, without a question, just takes the cake. You know, there's no city that comes close to Shawnee in terms of the number and the comprehensive nature of the new kind of regulations that they passed to target their homeless population and sort of and criminalize their essentially their existence. I'll start at the beginning, because it's a bit of a complex story. But what happened essentially is Shawnee, Oklahoma is a small city about 45 minutes from Oklahoma City, and it's got about 30,000 folks, and it's fairly poor, but even though it's a majority white city, a plurality of the homeless population is Native American. They've got about double the national rate of homeless people in Shawnee, you know, double the rate in the country as a whole. You know, the wintertime in Oklahoma can, sometimes it's fine, but sometimes it can get really, really cold. And so there's obviously a real need for shelter when it does start snowing, when the temperatures dip below. But right now there's really only one shelter in the city, a Salvation Army, that only has a few dozen beds, even though there are somewhere between 100 and 125 homeless people in Shawnee itself. So, fast forward to January 2011, there's a local homeless nonprofit that had won a major, major grant. We're talking $450,000 to renovate their facilities and turn that into an overnight shelter. You know, it was great. It was all paid for. All that they had to do was to get permission from the city commission to get their building rezoned. You know, they thought it was just going to be a basically just rubber stamping it, because, you know, why not? It wasn't going to cost the city a dime, all fully paid for and everything. Well, the vice mayor, who's the head of the city commission, James Herod, looked at it and realized that he and his wife own a lot of rental property nearby. And all of a sudden, their main concern is less the, you know, homeless people who are cold in the winter, and more how will this affect my property value? You know, this is a public official here voting on it. And so then this ends up leading...
I'm sure the city as a whole really cared about his property value, and that's why he cared about it.
Right. Well, and so he, you know, his wife ended up writing a letter to the city commission, his daughter, his son-in-law, et cetera. They all ended up writing a lot of letters and kind of driving up opposition to this. Even though the town as a whole, you know, the testimony in the letters, people were overwhelmingly in favor, they led a bit of an insurrection on the city commission, ended up convincing them to vote a 6-1 against the rezoning request. And so the shelter had to, the homeless nonprofit ended up having to forfeit the entire $450,000. They couldn't build the shelter just because they couldn't get the facility rezoned. And that, you know, and they didn't even stop there. The commissioner, James Herod, ended up then successfully pushing for a moratorium on building any new shelters in town. You know, just to throw another kind of wrench in the works and make sure that nothing could happen on this front. That's where it started, you know, with this would be a homeless shelter getting blocked. But that's not where actually the story ended with homelessness in Shawnee. This ended up leading to, there was right around this time, there was an effort to kind of beautify the downtown and revitalize the downtown district, which even in the report ended up basically singling out homeless people, you know, saying that, referring to them as the problem and saying that these are, this is something that we need to fix, essentially. And so what that led to was, pretty soon, these new regulations ended up coming out from the park department and new rules where they did everything from shutting off the water and the electricity in the parks because they didn't want homeless people to use them. Remember, these are public goods and, you know, they're for everybody, but they decided they didn't want certain people using these public goods. Taking out park benches because, at night some homeless people were sleeping on them instead of sleeping on the cold ground. So they took out these park benches and wanted to put back new ones that had the bar in the middle so nobody could lie down on them. Stopping handing out permits to charity groups that wanted to hand out food in the park, not giving them permission anymore to do that. And then happened?
That's just it really gets to a point where just one thing after another. And then to me, the real cherry on top, I guess you can say, is the actively stopping others who want to help the homeless.
We call this the criminalization of homelessness. You know, like homeless people, just like everybody else, they need to sleep. They need to use the bathroom. They need, they need to try to find somewhere to eat, et cetera. And so these types of policies, it's not designed to help them. It's not designed to help them better their situation. It's designed to criminalize the behaviors that they have to engage in to survive. What ended up happening, though, it wasn't just the city officials that ended up going on this front. There was also essentially a quasi-vigilante group that sprung up. They started acting under the auspices of a beautification campaign, but what this really amounted to was
They love that word, beautification, as if the homeless is some sort of blight on the city. I mean,
exactly.
Unbelievable how they use the language. It's continue. I'm sorry.
That's right. Well, and so what this group ended up doing was going around. And anytime they found evidence of homeless people, you know, whether they saw a tent or an old mattress or, you know, backpack or some sort of possessions where, folks have been living in the woods or something, they would just bring out the wood chipper and throw it in. You know, they didn't, if they ever found people, sometimes they would find people with the stuff and they would give them they would tell them, you've got a few days to pack up and move out. We're going to come back in 72 hours. If anything's still here, we're going to throw this in the wood chipper. You know, these people, these aren't people who are like camped out on this group's land. These are people who are hanging out on public land. These are, either public parks or museums or anywhere where they're allowed to, they have just as much right as anybody else to be there.
So who are these people to even have a say in anything? Yeah.
Right. Well, but this group essentially took it upon itself to say, we don't think those people deserve to be there. And so we're going to do something about it. They claim that, most of the stuff that we were throwing in the wood chipper was abandoned or old and crusty stuff. But, let's remember, that's also making a lot of assumptions about, just because you find it an old mattress doesn't mean that there's not somebody who's been sleeping on that.
Of course, because someone who's homeless would have a brand new mattress just waiting outside for them.
Right, exactly. And the wild thing about this as well was that this wasn't some group who was doing a like fly by night campaign. Which is why I say that they're not, it wouldn't be exactly right to call them a vigilante group, because it's their operations weren't just, it's not like they were being ignored by city officials. They were actually being actively celebrated. We found a thank you note written from the mayor to this group, thanking them for, handwritten, effusive, saying, the two words thank you cannot express enough to you for the wonderful things you're doing for the city. You and your friends are truly making a difference. I think this is reflective of an attitude that I found in the city of trying to create more of an atmosphere, less of helping people who are down on their luck and more of creating the atmosphere of self-deportation, trying to make life as cruel and miserable as possible that they'll go, leave town, go live somewhere else. Even though, a lot of these people, people who are in an unfortunate situation living in the woods or the park or wherever are from Shawnee or from the area. This is their home, even if they're not wealthy enough to be able to afford a house right now. And the city and a lot of people in it are trying to, have been trying to create an atmosphere where they are trying to push them out of town.
I just pulled up that letter you were reading. I'm sorry, I just have to continue a little bit. It goes on to wish the leader of that vigilante group, again, this is from the mayor, a Merry Christmas. I mean, really, just my God.
A healthy and prosperous new year.
Yeah, jeez. But you mentioned how a lot of these homeless people have been longtime, residents of Shawnee. Was Shawnee hit particularly hard by, a closing of a factory or the 2008 financial crisis? Is there something that is this a longstanding homelessness problem in Shawnee, or are these
Shawnee, and is reflective of Oklahoma in general in a lot of ways. Obviously with the history of it originally being settled by Native Americans who were kicked off their land out east in the middle of the 19th century, given this land for a couple of decades, and then, all of a sudden, white prospectors coming in and deciding, oh, it's some pretty nice land you've got there. Maybe we should, it's looking pretty good. Maybe we should settle it ourselves. And so a lot of the, it's been a fairly, a relatively poor area for a while, but a lot of that is also reflected in, is wrapped up in this sort of race and history of the city in general. Like I mentioned, I think it's 77% white, the city itself, but most of the homeless folks in town are Native American. So it's hard to kind of untangle the history of how Native Americans have been treated in the area from the present day fact that they still are lacking the same opportunities and the same outcomes that white people have been enjoying.
Mm-hmm. I mean, just like you mentioned at the top, that you've covered cities who deploy these, I guess, beautification tactics. You mentioned in your piece how Tampa banned people from sleeping in public areas. Palo Alto criminalized sleeping in cars. There's cities that have banned church volunteers to feed the homeless in public areas. There's cities who actively seek out to corral homeless people and then just basically bust them to another city, so it's not their problem. To hear that this there's a city out there that combines all of this is I don't know if I should say scary from just that perspective, or scary that there's so many cities employing tactics that you can find in this one city. I mean, it really
right.
is.
That's exactly right.
Has anything come out of this? Are there people in Shawnee or in Oklahoma in general who are actively working, whether it be on the ground or or lawmakers who are trying to bring about some sort of change to what's going on in Shawnee, or as you said, Oklahoma as a whole?
Yeah, it's a tough thing because at the same time, it's mostly a local zoning issue, at least as it relates to the the shelter that you know was fully funded and about to be built, but then nixed at the last minute. And the I interviewed the city commissioner James Herod, who he and his wife own millions of dollars in rental property in town, and were worried about their property value. He says he told me, you know, that they're quote unquote working on a sort of uniform standard that would end up lifting the moratorium. It seemed pretty clear that A, there wasn't any imminence to it, that it wasn't a priority, and B, that, you know, who knows what these standards will end up being, and C, the fact that they're so, you know, that they were this vehement and jazzed up against, essentially the best of situations. You had a homeless shelter for free, you know, that was all staffed, all paid for, and everything that the town wanted, that people were, you know, testifying and writing letters, all, you know, 2-1, 3-1 in favor of, and that they would reject it in those circumstances, I think gives you an indication that it's not going. I would be very surprised to see them reverse course anytime soon. Mm. Now that having been said, who knows whether or not enough pressure can be put on them, either from local uproar or state officials on down the line, but you know it doesn't seem like something that's going to end up changing overnight, unfortunately.
This city commissioner seems like a real great guy, doesn't he? I mean, I'm just reading through this reading through the piece you just reminded me when you brought up the letters from the public who were in favor of it. And how in your piece you state how the majority of the letters that were against it were all from this guy's family, as if he corralled them and said, "Hey, I need you to all do me a favor and write these letters." I'm sorry, what was that?
Yeah, the odd thing was that one of the primary letters opposed to the shelter was from Commissioner Herod's wife, saying that, you know, recently my tenants have moved out due to fears of not feeling safe and secure in their homes, that we're going to have trouble renting these. But when I interviewed the Commissioner Herod, he told me that the building right now, you know, where they're already have a soup kitchen and a food pantry, that it hasn't had any impact on their ability to rent properties. B, and this is a direct quote, it's not bothered the rental property at all. They're rented and they've never not been rented. And C, he claimed that they don't even care about the value of the rental property because they're not planning on selling or anything, and so it doesn't matter. It would essentially completely undercutting all of his wife's claims in the letter that she had sent to the city commission, which, you know, played a part in the commission ultimately rejecting the rezoning request. Take away from that what you will. You know, do you believe Commissioner Herod, or do you believe his wife, or is he just trying to change the story now that they've already kind of emerged victorious?
Yeah.
Who knows?
I mean, with the history of Oklahoma in general and of Shawnee that we know, and the majority of these homeless, like you stated, being Native Americans who were displaced from their land, it's just the irony in their letters and their actions of these rich white people coming in and again kicking these people off this public land, this land that's supposedly for everybody.
That's a great point. That's a great point. And one other point that I want to make clear here is this isn't just it's also not just an academic discussion about, you know, who should be on which land. This is, for some people, this ends actually is life and death. I mean, I mentioned the story about a man named Gary Lynn Roy who, he had a pretty rough life. He was a Native American, had been trying to combat alcoholism, was on the up and up, had been working construction, ended up having an accident on the job, fell through a roof, broke both his legs, and so he was homeless, sleeping outside by the railroad tracks, 12 blocks from where this shelter was supposed to be. This is last February, and then a big storm hit, and he ended up freezing to death. You know, just 6 inches of snow. He didn't live because he didn't have a house to be in, and he didn't have somewhere warm to be. And this is, you know, like almost within sight of where there was supposed to be a homeless shelter, where he could have stayed had it not been for, you know, the actions of the city commission.
It really is stunning, and it's a great piece. I urge all of our listeners to go to thinkprogress.org and read it. It's called "Welcome to Shawnee, Oklahoma: The Worst City in America to Be Homeless." Scott Kies, senior reporter for Think Progress, thank you so much for coming on the show and discussing this with us.
Great to chat with you. Thanks so much.
Take care.
Unbelievable.
It really is. I mean, it's disgusting. It's disgusting. Nothing that's being put here as, you know, let's beautify the city. Let's help get these homeless people off the streets. Nothing being put here is making the city better. So, nothing being put here is helping these people get out of homelessness. All it is forcing them off the streets.
Well, let me, you know,
none of these laws or city ordinances that are put into place ever solve the problem. They push it aside so homelessness is someone else's problem, and everyone pushes it aside to somebody else, to the point where everyone just keeps passing the buck, and no one actually helps these people. And when I say these people, I mean the homeless. And when I say the homeless, I mean it could be you. It could be me. Any of us can find ourselves in this position. This isn't something that you know, oh, these people have this thing that you know that only that can happen to them or whatever. I mean, even if it was, it wouldn't make any difference. But it can happen to anybody. And the fact that these rich people who own land, who own property, want to just only care about how they can make an extra buck. I mean, it really is stunning. It really is stunning. The fact they do it under they think they're doing the right thing too. That's what really gets me. Like, you know what? If you want to be an asshole, just come out and admit, yeah, I want to make more money. It's all about the money to me. Fuck the homeless. You know, that would mean more. We'll make a note of that. 12:57. You can make a note of that.
That's what's
going on here. Like, just say it. I would rather you just say that than come out and say, you're doing great things. We're all doing great things here. We're being real good. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. The Lord be with you. Yet really, though, like, really, it's disgusting.
It's disgusting.
And with that, we'll bring into the funner half
of
the show.
I'll take you to the funner half. We're going to take one. I guess you put on Mission Impossible. Real quick.
No, we're going to do what are you talking about? La Poupée, buddy.
Oh, I misunderstood you, buddy. All right, we're going straight to La Poupée. But wait, we got to do the pitch then.
Become a member today at majority.fm, majorityapp.com. Go there to download the app. You can support the show by going to majorityreportkickback.com. That will take you to our app. That will take you to Amazon. You won't have to go anywhere else. It'll take you to Amazon, but by going through that link, you give us a kickback via whatever purchase you make through Amazon. We get a small itty-bitty percentage, but, you know, when enough people do that, that small itty-bitty percentage becomes a small itty percentage. So that's how you can support this show. You can subscribe to us at subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/SamCedar. Follow us on Twitter at MajorityFM. Like us on Facebook, facebook.com/MajorityReport. We will see you in the funner half of the show, where we have tons of great stories. Michael will kick that off. We've got Michael's got a bunch of stories, international affairs stories, as Michael likes to call it. And we got sound clips and more. We will talk to you in the better half. Oh, and Sam will be live tomorrow from Vegas.